There are many of us at the shows who meet and talk to John Sharp. John is an amazing man. His intellect and intelligence almost has no bounds. In a conversation with John, you'll get jovality combined with intelligence and knowledge. And those three combined make for some special conversations. But many people who meet John would never realise that there is another side to him. John suffered some time ago from a psychotic episode, and the journey from illness to health and well-being was somewhat long and somewhat difficult. In a conversation, I said to John that we would be focusing on areas of mental health over the next few days. And John asked me to do something. He asked me if he could take the recorder and a microphone and go and sit somewhere quiet and make a statement. A statement of kindness. Because he wanted to explain his feelings on mental health and talk about his own story and talk about it so as to help anybody who may be in difficulty themselves. I would guide the listener to understand that in the 20 minutes of John's words, there are some very traumatic situations he will speak of. However, I think that the openness of this incredible words of kindness must be acknowledged. And to anybody who listens to it, you'll find the depths and breadth of a man of such great capacity and mental faculty. And he is evidence that even in our darkest hours, there is help and respite. Thank you for listening to this introduction.
Good afternoon from the Victoria Centre. My name is John Sharp, and I'm part of the Liz Ian Events team. I would like to talk about an issue that has really come to the fore in recent years, in the way that it's being dealt with, the way it's being addressed, and the way it's being treated. And this is a mental awareness, health awareness issue. There has been so much stigma, so much misunderstanding over the years about what that is, because people that suffer from various aspects of mental health are not always recognised or not always diagnosed, because you can see them out and about in the street and they seem to be perfectly okay on the surface, but when you get to talk to them, it's pretty obvious that there are issues, underlying issues there. We live in a world that is constantly busy, that is constantly making demands on us and making demands on our time. And we're rushing around and we're not really taking care of ourselves properly. But when we do, we tend to concentrate on the body aspect of this thing, health, fitness, nutrition, the visible side of things, and we seem to neglect the actual mental well-being that's underlying our very being and makes us ultimately who we are, our personalities, our psyches, and so forth. What I'm going to talk about here is how it affected me. I shall start, what seems oddly, with a car accident in July of 2002. I was knocked down on a crossing, and it was a near-fatal car accident. I won't go into the details here, The medical profession dealt with the most visible signs. I had a swollen jaw, I had cuts, I had bruises, and the medical profession were dealing with the most visible signs of that because they were the most obvious. What did not happen at the time is the proper tests and the proper scans weren't done, x-rays on the other parts of my body that had visible injuries. Particularly, what was not investigated were my head injuries. I had injuries to the temple, injuries, as it turned out later on, to the sinuses. I was in a very high-powered job at the time, and it was very clear that my health had been adversely affected, my physical health and my psychological health as well, but I kept very quiet about it. I should have said something at the time. I was suffering severe headaches, I was suffering anxiety. It wasn't until just come back from holiday, it's the first time, been away for a week, it's the first time I'd been on a plane in years. I had nosebleeds, severe nosebleeds, for a week, and I went to see a consultant neurologist at the City Hospital in Nottingham. Anyway, he did an armchair diagnosis, mentioned the accident. He saw no connection between the accident and the nosebleeds. Now, I should point out that the injuries to me during the accident were on the left side of my body, and the nosebleed was only out of the left nostril, not the right nostril, and that was the side of the head I was getting the severe headaches on. Anyway, he asked me at the end, was I satisfied with this diagnosis? And I said, absolutely not. I want a second opinion. I saw a neurologist at the Queen's Medical Centre. He checked me out thoroughly, absolutely ran a battery of tests, and he was concerned that my eye-hand brain coordination was just not right at all. I was still working at this point in time, and we're about to make an office move. I seem to get through that okay, and then we get into 2005. This is the end of 2004. In 2005, my sister was training to be a crystal healer and Reiki therapist, and I was her guinea pig. And recently she's gone through her notes and she could see a deterioration in me throughout 2005. There was another office move, and I believe that was a trigger, a serious trigger. I started losing sleep, my general well-being went downhill, I just wasn't myself. I felt run down, I just felt really stressed, really under pressure. Anyway, I was taking things recommended by the doctor for my sleep deprivation. None of it seemed to work at all. One night, I was at home, and going back over this is really, really traumatic even now, and it's what I call my dark night of the soul, where quite frankly things have got to a stage where I could see no other way out and I tried to kill myself. And when you think you're in your own home, which should be the safest environment, your parents are there as well, but another part of the house, I was on the window ledge in my own room and pitch black outside. And I just went out the window. Didn't realise it was it. It had been raining heavily. The ground was soft. And I'd also hit something on the way down. It was something, not something hard, something like a bush or something. And there I was at the back door, banging on the back door. My parents saw me, you know, sort of bleeding. They saw me bruised, they saw me drenched to the skin. Rushed me inside, cleaned me up, put me to bed, gave me some painkillers. Immediately the following day they called the doctor. And there I was in bed. It was highly embarrassing when my GP comes running up the stairs and he's standing alongside my bed. One day I come home from work and the attitude in my parents is completely different. They say, there are two gentlemen here in the living room. And I go in and the living room is in semi-darkness, there's only one light on. And they tell me to sit down. I knew something was off here, really, really off. And they explained who they were and explained why they were there and why there was the concern. It was more for my own well-being because I was not a danger to anyone else, I was only a danger to myself. So they can either use the easy way or the hard way, and I didn't want to inquire what the hard way was. Anyway, I went out into the hall. My parents had packed some cases and said it was for my own good. I went with a gentleman into a car. Thank God it was the dead of night. And I was locked in this car and I asked them a whole load of questions, but they didn't tell me anything. Just wait and see. I saw the bulk of the Queen's Medical Centre coming up and I thought, my God, this is it. It's really got to this. It really seriously has. When we got up in the elevator, they were standing either side of me like bodyguards. We got to the ward. And it's very clear it was going to be a secure ward, that I was going to be sectioned. I got admitted into the ward, I got registered in. I'd only been there about 10-15 minutes and I saw a chance of escaping. So I tried to leg it down the corridor. The next thing I know, two blokes, one grabbed me by the other arm and literally dragged me back in. One of them stood in front of the door, literally pinning the door closed. I went from a section one to a section two, bang. Was barely there about a week, and I tried to kill myself on the ward. The alarm bells rang, there was a red light flashing, the door burst open, they just got to me in time. But my time on there, I was in hospital a total of 6-7 months. That was the Queen's Medical Centre, A43, then it was Highbury Hospital, when my section got lifted. What I decided to do when I was at an A43, I thought, while I'm here, I might as well make use of my time while I'm recuperating. So I asked for the art materials, it was whether it was paints, whether it was colouring pencils, whatever, and lots of paper. And I started an art therapy group. And every time my parents came in, my family members came in, they saw more and more people around the table trying to draw more and more people to take their minds off where they were. But what happened on the ward, they would pump you full of various medication, and I don't think they seemed to care what the medication was. It was almost like it was making their life easy, so they didn't have to deal with you. It was like putting you to sleep like a baby. It's sort of feeding you, then the psychiatrist doing your daily check report, see how you were going, and that's how the cycle was. So that art therapy was really helping. The first lot of medication really concerned my parents because it had turned me into what appeared to be a robot. My eye-hand brain coordination, which wasn't really good already, was even worse, and they had to put me on more pills to mitigate that. I was still having sleep trouble, but I managed to break that cycle. I was put on Zopiclone, and it was 3 nights of that, and I thought, I'm going to break the cycle myself. I didn't like this whole medication thing. I've come to realise that there were people there worse than me. A lot worse than me, a lot more severe than me. I was one of those people that was highly articulate, highly sociable, could interact with people and engage with people. And I could see other people there wondering what on earth I was doing there. See, so I asked myself what I was doing there. But I came to realise nobody was going to help me but me. Nobody was, not the psychiatrists, not the doctors, not the nurses, no one. No one was. I got myself to a stage where I was admitted to Highbury Hospital in Bulwell. The Section 2, as I said, had been lifted. And after a certain time, I was allowed to sort of go out, initially escorted round to make sure that I didn't come to any harm or any danger. And then you could go round by yourself. And that feeling of liberty, just to be able to walk round the grounds, not bodyguarded, not watched, not kind of pumped full of medication, was a real sense of release. It really was. You're out in the fresh air by yourself when all you've been seeing was like a ward. And the only exercise you got was walking up and down that ward when escorted out to the garden, wherever, to get a breath of fresh air. It was like being in prison. And believe me, I have worked in prisons. I've worked in police stations. I know what it's like to have that shutting kind of feel. It's really, really horrible to have that liberty taken away. At least when you're at work, you can get out at lunchtime, you can get out at the end, but when you've been sectioned, you really are contained, you're confined. And for somebody like me, who's very sociable, very outgoing, very gregarious, and who loves life, that was horrible, the worst possible thing that could have happened. But the nurses at Highbury were absolutely fantastic. One of them gave me a copy of the Celestine Prophecy. The Celestine Prophecy was a life-affirming book. I can still not work out whether or not it was fact or fiction or a mixture of both. But it was this journey that the writer was going on, the narrator that was going on, and they were finding new things. They were having these wonderful experiences. It was almost like a dawn of spiritual awareness, their dawning spiritual awareness. So when I look back on those days, I realised how lucky I was. I really do. When I sat in front of that final panel of psychiatrists and I realised I was going to be released, and I was sitting in front of that panel, I came to realise that that was the day I was going to be released from Highbury. There were three or four psychiatrists, and the head of the panel, she explained what was going to happen, that they felt my progress had got to a stage when I could be, rather than just going on day release or weekend release, under the guardianship of my parents, almost like going from sort of being in like a prison to being like the prison of your own home. And then she explained that she couldn't call my condition manic depression. They couldn't call that anymore. And that was 2006, by the way. I'd been in the system for 6 months, 7 months. Call it bipolar. Now, I'd never heard of bipolar. Well, she said it was a spectrum. And she explained there was severe at one end and less severe at the other end. It was all to do with numbers on the spectrum. I made a joke. No joking with therapy, as it turns out. Bipolar, does that mean I can see both ends of the world at the same time? No laughs. Even my parents weren't laughing. That day I got released from Highbury, that was that. But what I had behind me, I was very, very lucky. To be under occupational health when I got back to work, I had a full-time job. I had a fantastic boss. I had supportive work colleagues. And I was phased back into work on alternate days, then 3 days a week, then 5 days a week. So they eased me back in gently. But the first day back, I was sat round a table in the boardroom. There was the occupational health therapist that was dealing with my case. There was my case worker that had been assigned to me. There was human resources that used to be called personnel. There was my immediate boss, about 9-10 of us around the table. And we best basically talked it through. And I said to them, look, I'm one of the lucky ones, I've said. I've got a good job, I've got a good family, I've got a good support network. To throw it all away would have been absolutely ridiculous. I'm going to use the word crazy here, because it would have been crazy. So when I said, yeah, I want to carry on with the job, my boss says, right, you might as well take off your jacket, go back downstairs and carry on where you left off. And that was absolutely brilliant. But what I'm going to do to end here is there's a very, very, very sad another part to this. A family friend of 30 years standing, she sadly passed away in 2014. She had a son of about my age, just a little bit older. He'd had a car accident. What had happened was he was out walking the dog one day and the dog ran out into the road. I don't think it was on a leash. He ran out into the road and the dog got saved, but he got hit by the car that otherwise have hit the dog. It left him with head injuries and he had a nervous breakdown because of that car accident. He ended up getting sectioned. So it almost seemed like a mirror of what I'd been through. But the thing was, talking through this with the lady, this family friend, it was harrowing for me, upsetting for me to actually talk about what I'd been through. But I thought, if what I'd been through, the fact that her son had been through something similar, if I could help her and help him get through this, that would be all to the good. It really, really would. It would have had a purpose behind it in some bizarre kind of way. Sadly, his mental state got worse, it spiraled downwards, and he committed suicide. And she'd always said that if her son had ever committed suicide, that would be it for her, and sadly she's now gone too. So unfortunately for her and her son, that had a sad ending. But the thing is, mental health, even nowadays, is still misunderstood. There is still a stigma attached. But talking through it, going through it with other people can help. there will be people out there who are going through traumatic times, stressful times, for whatever reason. And I'm saying, don't bottle it in. Don't hold it back. Talk it through with your family. Talk it through with your friends, for goodness sake. Just talk it through with somebody. Because that kind of getting it off your chest, it does help. It's therapy. It really is. And if you can avoid getting to the stage where you end up in a hospital feeling isolated, nobody wants to go to that stage. They really don't. So please, please, at the first sign you feel that something is wrong, please seek a help from a GP, go to a doctor. If there's anything like I went through, like having trouble sleeping, because that can be the first sign that something is wrong, do please get help. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you have a good afternoon.
There is nothing I can add to those words. For somebody to become so intimate with their experience, an experience that many people would put into a cupboard and hope it would never reveal itself again, is the depth of this man. His words are spoken not from his own need to have a cathartic exercise. These words are spoken for John's need to help other people who may be going through the same journey. They are words of hope, words of kindness. Thank you for listening to John's words.